Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Phillies Backstage. I'm Tom Burgoyne, joined by Director of Fun and Games, John Brazier. And, John, I still can't believe that we haven't had this guest on. How long have we been doing this podcast?
We've been doing this podcast for 3.5 years. Just every week we finish our podcast after a great guest, and we say, you know, who haven't we got yet? And then I think it was TJ Farrell in our office said, hey, you never got Dickie Knowles. And I'm like, yeah, we did. We probably got him way long time ago.
I thought he was one of our first guests.
He works in our office. He's good buddies of ours. And all of a sudden, I look back through this through the guests and no Dickie Knowles.
And I didn't believe you, John. So I looked too. I went through the whole thing. I'm like, no, Dickie was definitely like the first month we were we went on and started this podcast. But sure enough.
Well, better late than never, right?
Better late than never. He's with us today, Dickie. No,
I was with him all day yesterday,
and I'm totally honored to be on your podcast.
Tremendous.
And I never even—I remember Johnny telling me, I don't know. You told me one time before you'd like to be on the podcast, and I told you
probably
no.
3.5 years. But yeah, right.
But
maybe
I always
that's what it was.
Him.
3.5 years ago. Yeah.
No, it wasn't 3.5 years ago. It was like 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
But you guys were just together golfing yesterday. Is that right?
Dickie's on the circuit with Tommy Green.
Oh, that's
Mickey
a good
Moore,
circuit
Mickey
to be
Morandini,
on,
Whoa. Myself.
Time out. Circuit? You know how many times I've played golf this year?
Well, I'm not saying this year because okay. I've only all golfed right. twice.
How many, this
but in
like,
the past, we've golfed together.
You got to be careful. Our bosses may be listening to this.
That's true.
Well, but, that's part of your job, Dickie. You're supposed to, you know, go out there, golf.
The first time I golfed with Dickie, and I'm a hack golfer. I'm basically a hockey player playing golf. And one time, Dickie, remember this? We were playing in a tournament, and I hit this. It was like a par three. I hit a shot. Right after I hit the shot, I think I was spewing expletives.
You.
And
wow.
It went, Dickie, remember? It went to the top of the hill. You describe it.
It was almost a hole in one. I mean, it was a great shot on a par three. We were struggling, and Johnny comes up. He hits a ball, and I thought it was going to land on the road out there. It went way out left, and it was a windy day, too, so the wind kind of pulled it a little bit. But he had a cut shot. We ain't going to call it a slice. We'll call it a cut shot.
You're
and
very that thing, generous.
That thing started coming back, and it landed about 3 feet from the cup.
I mean, it rolled about 50 feet, literally. I hit the wrong side of the place, and somehow it came down perfectly.
Back. It didn't hit a tree and
no,
ricochet.
And I think I won closest to the pin for that.
You did.
So, yeah. Yeah, sometimes luck pays to be better than skill, right?
He can hit some bombs.
Yeah.
But he don't hit them straight. He hits them to the right, and then he hits them to the left. Yeah. No, he can hit some straight.
Yeah, so yesterday you were not good?
I actually putted well. And actually, Dickie, no, this has no reflection on you, but we did birdie the last three holes because you left a little early.
Did Tommy take
but
all of my shots?
We had Tommy took his both shots.
Yeah.
So we had, you know, when you have Tommy, yes, having a practice shot, basically, you do pretty well. Tommy, if you remember the Bugs Bunny episode when, you know, he hits the ball.
Three
and
screamer.
Screaming line drive and the ball screaming. That's
a great
Tommy's,
analogy.
That's Tommy's golf ball.
Golf ball. Tommy's the best golfer I've ever seen outside of Michael Jack.
Yeah.
I mean, Tommy's whole game is amazing. He hits the ball. I mean, if I don't know how the golf ball survives because it's got to be getting compressed more than anybody else's golf ball. And then he hits it straight. And when he's hot, am I lying? He hits a 3-iron closer than I hit a pitching wedge.
And he's a technician, right? And he's like, yeah. No, you do
he's
this, you do that.
He's slow. He's slow when he plays golf. Yeah. Not slow, methodical.
Methodical, yes.
But
good word.
When he lines that golf ball up and he gets himself ready, he don't miss.
No.
Now, when you're playing with Tommy, Dickie, do you have a specialty you bring? I mean, Tommy off the tee, it's hard to outdrive Tommy.
Well, but he can bomb the ball.
You're out there with Tommy or what?
Dickie can totally bomb the ball.
Nobody's out when he's hitting it well. When he's not hitting it well, like we were down to shore playing golf and at a 2-day event down there, and I outdrove him. So I couldn't wait for him to drive down there. I was like, man, I don't know how my ball got farther than his ball. So he drives down, he gets down there, and he looks at his ball. And I've outdrove him once or twice before. And I say twice in my lifetime. He says more than that, but I'm right. He's wrong. I've hit some drives before. I've hit them good, and I look up, and he's 75 yards ahead of me.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? I mean, yep. He could – so this particular drive, I knew I hit it over 300 yards, and I'm 65 years old. So it's downwind, and it was only a 35-mile-an-hour wind, so I'm taking it, you know, anyway. I mean, the wind's behind us, and I said, I looked over, and I told the guy that was riding with me, I said, John, I outdrove him. So I'm going to wait on him. So he comes down, and he looks at it. Because the last time I outdrove him, he drove out there and outdrove him. He goes, you know, I didn't hit mine good. I towed it. Right. I was going, well, can you keep that to yourself?
Yeah, right.
So this time he didn't say anything.
He towed it.
And I was looking. I was going, he didn't say anything. I said, did you hit that one good? He goes, yeah. I didn't even want to play golf no more. I was already done for the day. I was going, I outdrove Tommy Green. You know, but
hey, question for you. Because a lot of these guys, when they go on road trips, especially our announcers, right. They golf in Oakmont, and they'll golf at all the great golf courses. Is it different from, like, back in the 80s, when you were playing with the Phillies and the Cubs and all the different teams, did you guys golf as much as the current ball players golf?
I don't think so. I never golfed when I was a Philly. When I went to Chicago, Ferguson Jenkins, who was one of my dear friends in life, and Fergie walked up to me one day in spring training and said, the Wilson guy just offered you clubs, or I think it was like $250. And I said, yeah, I took the money. He goes, no, call him back. So he called the Wilson guy back, and he said, he wants clubs.
Nice.
And the Wilson guy said, okay. And he says, the clubs are worth a lot more than $250, and you're going to play golf. I said, well, I go to a driving range. Let's go. So the first time I went out to play golf, it was with Larry Boa and Ferguson Jenkins and Keith Moreland, and I forget who else was with us, but we played a match, we're competitive. Everybody's competitive. So I got a little too
competitive. Larry Boa's not competitive.
Well, I got a little too competitive with Larry Boa.
Right.
And with a foot wedge, he beat me by about 15 strokes. So I was determined to get him back. So I practiced, and I fell in love with the game right away.
There it was. That's when you started playing.
Yep.
And you mentioned all of Phillies. That was basically the Cubs back then were Phillies West.
Yes, we were. And we paid a dear price for it. When we got traded over there, they hated us. They hated all of us until we started winning.
Right.
But I'll never forget the night I was traded, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a different era in my life. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and Tommy Helms pulls up beside me, and he looks at me and he goes, "Hey, you're a Cub now." And I go, first of all, this is kind of weird. You know, I've been out on the town. He's been out on the town. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's pulled up beside me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm dreaming or is this real. I looked at him. I said, "Tommy, what are you doing?" He goes, "I don't know. I seen you. I knew that was your car." I said, "We're on the other side of town. You pull up beside me and you roll your window down and say, 'Hey, you've been traded.'" I said, "Are you messing with me?" He goes, "No, you've been traded. I seen it on a television night. I want to congratulate you. You're going to Chicago. Better keep the ball down there, kid."
Mm. I mean, I know we were going to talk about your career, Dickie, but that was such a fascinating time when Dallas went over there and Vuk, and then all of a sudden all these trades started happening. I guess you got traded with Keith Moreland.
Right.
Right? And we got Kruko in the deal. I think we needed starting pitching
back
then. Yeah, we needed that.
Even Lee Elia came over there.
Lee Elia. But how did it – you say people didn't like it. Like, how did that manifest itself? Was it the fans? Or are you talking about, like, the front office people? Or, like
I think it was the fans and the media. I think you know, you got a brash general manager coming over there saying, "We're going to win here. You ain't never won before, but we're going to win." Right. And you need lights. You
right.
need those things up there called lights.
That really must have ruffled some feathers.
That's why they got lights, because of Dallas Green.
Dallas.
Dallas talked about lights all the time. The thing I remember the most was when we got traded over there. You know, my heart was heartbroken to leave Philadelphia. And it really bothered me leaving Philadelphia. I said, man alive, I must have really messed up to leave Philly. I mean, because, you know, I didn't have a great year, and Pope was a little upset with me, and so I thought about it, and I said, I need to get my act in order. And so that year I went home, and I wanted to get ready. We didn't work out the way guys do here, but I started working out, and I wanted to get ready, and I came into spring training, and I looked at the club, and I thought, okay, Moreland's here. Dan Larson went with us, and Boa hadn't come quite yet, but okay. Then Boa came later.
Bobby Dernier?
Yeah, but that was much later.
Boa
and Sandberg came next. So I'm looking at the club now, and I'm thinking, well, you know what? Because I knew the Cubs. I love pitching against the Cubs at that time. They were not very good. And so I seen that, and I looked at the paper of, you know, what we got now, and then I thought, man, still it's okay, but it's a good start. I'm going to get to start over there. And for me, I got 30-something starts. I went 10 and 14 or 10. I can't remember. 10 and 14, I think. 10
and
13.
And they brought you over as a starter, because that's what I was going to say. With your career, Dickie, you know, you bounce back and forth a little bit out of the bullpen, and then you start. But you started mostly for the Cubs, huh?
Yeah, and until I had a knee injury. But that first year, you know, we got Sandberg playing third. You got Bump Wills at second because he had a two-year contract. And you got Bowe at short, and you got Durham at first. And starting to look like a pretty good little ball club, because I could see that, you know, that it was going to be a good ball club. You had young kid Mel Hall coming up in the outfield. Jody Davis, fantastic catcher. And you had Ferguson Jenkins, who was still pitching very well at the time. And I looked at the pitching staff and went, if I can't pitch in this rotation, I'm in trouble. But it was a club that probably wasn't going to win, but they knew that we were going to get rid of Bump. Sandberg's going to go to second, and they were going to go out and sign some guys. And then they got Sarge, Bobby D, Dick Ruthven, I believe, came before that. They got Dick Ruthven. Then all of a sudden you got Dennis Eckersley, and we're looking at the club now like, wow.
Yeah.
So we went from a club that nobody came to see. We had no fans. And that's why you remember the Lee Ilya rant?
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, everybody knows that one. But they booed us all the time because they didn't like the Phillies. They thought that we had, you know, very popular guy, Mike Kruko, won 20 games, got traded. So anyway,
guys also won the World Series in 1980, so they're probably looking and saying, at least you have some winners and kind of bringing that culture into the clubhouse, right?
I think they were too blind to see that Dallas was going to do that. They looked at the players he brought in at first, you know, Porfirio Altamirano and Dickie Knowles and Keith Moreland did not ring a bell to the Chicago fans, and Keith later became a very good hitter and a good ball player, an all-star player. And then until they started bringing guys over, and Larry Bowles at the end of his career, no offense to that, but that didn't charge him up either. And what happened when they got Dick Ruthven, you got a proven winner. Then you got Gary Matthews, proven winner. We were proven winners, but these guys I'm talking about had played all-star teams and things like that. And then you got Bobby Dunier. Now you looked at the club and went, whoa, this is a pretty good ball club. And then you put Dennis Eckersley on that ball club, and then later Sutcliffe came on that and got traded over there. And to see that, I was there half of 84, I got traded. But to see the first half of 84 unfold and see all the fans, all the sellout, and Rhino having a great year he had, and the Cub fans have, it seems to me, since 1984, they've been selling out ever since.
Yeah, even with the lights. They came in 88. I remember that, John. I went to the game before, because remember, it was a Monday night baseball game.
That's right.
First night with that first game. And remember, it got rained out. Gary Reedus, yep. I think, started the game with a home run, but it got wiped off the books because the rain came like in the second inning, and they had to start the next night. But I was at the game the night before, and there was a petition, like, get rid of the lights. It's like, I think it's too late, buddy. They're going on tomorrow night.
It's a beautiful ballpark. I went back there for Lee Smith's induction, or not his induction, after he was inducted in Hall of Fame, for his the retirement of his number, and walking back in there and just seeing that ballpark, what they've done with it, it's pretty spectacular. It's hard to believe that they could do the things they did to the ballpark.
Oh yeah,
especially with the locker room and
now,
stuff.
Now, Dickie, you threw a one hitter, right,
against
the Reds,
Cincinnati Reds,
in 1982. Talk about that game. When was the one hit?
It was a single by Ed Milner in the fourth inning, and it could have been caught. But it was so early. I mean, our left fielder's a good friend of mine, Steve Henderson, said, I could have called it easy, but if it was spinning and bounced, if it bounces, it's going to bounce away from me and be a double. And it was I was pitching against Tom Seaver. What I remember about that game is I got a knock off Tom Seaver. It could have been a no-hitter, but it was a one-hitter. It was probably the best game I've ever thrown in my career.
Awesome. All right, well, speaking of your career, let's talk about an incident that took place that actually turned your life around. Right? In 1983, now, you'll be the first one to admit you were kind of a wild player, right? You stayed out late, and you were drinking this and that, but I guess in 1983, you were briefly jailed for assaulting a Cincinnati police officer. And then talk about that, and then talk about how that incident then really changed your life around for the positive.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Any incident that happens like that, you wonder how you got that far. I'd been in trouble many times in my career. There's a lot of rumors that go around about my life. They're starting to die out now. I'm getting old enough to get rid of them, but it was that I got arrested in every minor league city. And I used to kind of think about that and say, no, I didn't. And yet I thought about it and I said, yeah, I did. I got arrested in Spartanburg. I got arrested in Peninsula. I got arrested in Reading, but I never went to jail in Reading. They let me go when I went to the police station. I got arrested in Oklahoma City. I go, man, that's not a good resume. And then I got called up to the Phillies in 1979, went to Venezuela, got kicked out of the country there. I've always thought back to that. Did I really get kicked out of the country? And then I talked to Tony Taylor and Ruben. They go, yeah, you got kicked out of the country. Can't go back. And so after 1979, we won the World Series in 1980. And I do not recall that I got arrested in 1980. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And then in 1981, I'm arrested again for a fight and sent to the minor leagues and had another one there. And you look at that and you think, wow, what kind of guy is this? And I never really took a look at myself until April 9th of 1983. And the interesting thing about that April 9th date was I had stopped drinking in spring training. And Dallas brought me in. It's a kind of a funny story. I'm trying to think of his name now, but he was
Hold on, Dick. You know what? Before you get into that story, because we want to get into that, let's take a break right now, Tom, right?
Good idea. We'll be right back right after this.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
All right, and we're back. And Dickie, talking about, I know, a crazy time back in 1983, huh?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of the gentleman's name, and I can't think of his name, but he worked in baseball. He was an alcoholic, and Ryan Durham, a hard-throwing right-hander for the New York Yankees. Dallas Green had called him and told him he wanted him to come to talk to me in spring training, and he came up to me and had a little beer belly on him, and he walked over to him, and he says, hey, I'm Ryan Durham. Well, you're going to be respectful to someone that's played the game. So I was very respectful until he got to talking to me about my drinking. And he said, let me ask you a question. And I said, all right, go ahead. And he said, you ever been in a fight sober? I go, yeah. And he goes, as an adult? And I go, yeah. And he goes, how many times? And I had to think about it. And he goes, do you like fighting? And I go, no, not at all. Do you consider yourself, I'm sober now. He said, do you consider yourself a fighter? I said, absolutely not. And he goes, well, let me read your resume off, you know. And he says, this is before I got arrested and for assaulting police officers. So he tells me that, and as all alcoholics do, you don't think you're an alcoholic. I didn't need to drink every day. I never had the shakes. When I quit, it was no big deal. You know, I mean, as far as having withdrawal or anything like that. So he tells me, he says, can you quit drinking for 2 weeks? So I looked at him and said, yeah, easy. I said, that's all you want from me? And he goes, yeah, if you can quit drinking for 2 weeks, I'll see you in 2 weeks. So he left town. We had another pitcher on the club, God rest his soul. He's passed away, and me and him went to play horseshoes. And you can't play horseshoes without beer. Just can't, not in Arizona. So we're playing horseshoes, and some guy, he met some fans. And so we're sitting there, and they're in their backyard. It's a good horseshoe pit. We're playing horseshoes. And he goes, you want a beer? I go, yeah. Didn't even think about it. So after about 6, 8, 9 beers, you know, we're playing horseshoes. And I said, oh, man, I was supposed to stay. I'll start tomorrow. Then the next day, Fergie and some guys were having some shrimp and a few beers. And they're cooking the shrimp and beer. So I said, I don't think I'm going to drink. I got to do this Ryan Duren thing. And I said, I'll start tomorrow. So by the time Ryan Durham came back and he said, Dickie, did you have anything to drink? Now, there was two of us, and that's why I'm not going to mention this other guy's name. So he looked at me, and he looked at the other guy, and he says, did you guys have anything to drink? And I said, no. And he said, yeah. And I said, what? He goes, yeah, we did. I said, we? What do you mean we? I said, speak for yourself. I was a little mad at him. And Ryan looked at me, and he said, you lie to protect your drinking. Probably is a pretty good sign you got a drinking problem. And I go, okay, I'm not going to lie. I had a few drinks, and he said, okay, I'm going to give you one more chance. He said, I tell you what, tomorrow I'm leaving town. I'm going to call you, and I'm going to call you in 1 week, and you be honest with me and tell me how much you've had to drink. Well, I knew he was a direct pipeline to Dallas, so I went 1 week without drinking. But the funny thing about that week, I was pitching better. So we're creatures of habit, both good and bad, athletes, you know, and so I said, I'm not going to drink. I'm pitching good. So the next week I didn't drink, and I was pitching really good. By the end of spring training, I was almost unhittable. I remember I never struck out 10 in a major league game, but I struck out 10 in a minor league game. And at my last game I pitched, I struck out 12, I think, in back-to-back games. One game was a 7-inning game. The other game was an 8-inning. We pitched a little longer in spring training then. I think the other game, I went into the eighth inning, and all the Milwaukee Brewers, who I was facing a pretty good club with the Brewers. I mean, they had some studs on that team that could hit. You had Molitor, you had Yount, you had Cecil Cooper,
Gorman.
And you had Ogilvy, Storm and Gorman. I was getting ready. And they all were telling me after the game, and Paul Molitor in particular said, "Dickie, man, you're throwing the ball better than ever. I cannot believe you're pitching now. You got a purpose out there." So that hit me. I said, you know what? You know, this drinking thing may have been taking me a little bit down the, you know, maybe it hurt me on the field too. So I quit drinking, and I felt great. And then we went to Cincinnati. I pitched the first game of the season, I believe, against Montreal, against Bill Gullickson, got beat 1-0. But after the game, so many people were telling me how well I was commanding the ball, and I'd never heard that before. And not only that, how well I was commanding, you know, the fastball, but how I was keeping my motions in control on the mound. And so that stuff was kind of boring to a lot of people, but I was really listening to it going, you know what, I am a different person when I drink. So we went to Cincinnati. We had an off day there, since it's been printed, I can mention Scotty's name. Scotty Moneyhoff, great friend of mine, number one draft pick from the Phillies, wonderful, wonderful human being, and his wife. They're wonderful people. I'd love to see them again. So we went into they came up to my room, and they wanted to go out drinking. And the only thing is, I don't want people to take this the wrong way. Scotty said, when you drink with me, you never get in fights, and you're okay. Come on, one last time for good friends. Come on. And Scotty was trying to get into baseball. So I said, you know what? It ain't going to hurt to go out one last time. And that one last time for so many alcoholics is a tragedy for me. I was very lucky. So we went out, and once I got to drinking, we went to one bar. We left that bar, and we went into a place, and a big fight erupted. And if you ask me about the fight, I probably couldn't tell you anything about what happened at the fight. I have no idea. The interesting thing was, you know, Murph from Fantasy Camp, Dennis Murphy?
Yep.
His son was in a league, and the bouncer son was playing in the league, and he said, I can tell Dickie everything that happened that night. And I asked Murph for his phone number, and then I said, well, I don't want to go back and call. What I want to look at is everything that happened that night was, with the history of what I did, was all my fault. I mean, it's pretty obvious that I got out of control. I don't remember seeing a police officer. Officer Kim Cohen was his name. I tried to locate him a couple times. The AA part of life is, you know, you follow the 12 steps, but in the 12 steps, there's a step in there that you make amends to others. And I said, I need to make amends to this gentleman. And so I reached out one time. I read in the newspaper where his son had tragically died in a fire on the front page of USA Today. A fire that was in it was college. I can't remember the name of the college right now. But so I reached out for the second time, and it depends on who answers the phone on the other end. I didn't get very lucky, but I do remember talking to someone about him in Cincinnati, and I don't recall the conversation or how it happened, but I was trying to locate him, of somebody talking about what a great guy he was, you know, a sports guy, a community type guy. And then it made me feel even worse. So I didn't want to go back and say, well, who did I beat up if I beat up somebody? But the bottom line was, I struck a police officer somehow during the fight. So they sentenced me to 180 days in a jail. And I went to jail that night. There's a story that floats around. It's a pretty funny story. Vukovic came to the jailhouse, and Lee Ilya and Dallas Green and Billy Connors, all the old Phillies. And they said they had to be strapped in a chair. And they asked the police, they said, why do you have him strapped in a chair? Can you undo him? And they went, no. Vuk said, I they didn't want to let you go. And I said, that may sound funny to a lot of people. It may sound macho to a lot of people, like they were afraid to let me go because, you know, this guy's going to go off again. But it sounds pretty embarrassing when you're the guy that wakes up the next day sober and you go, they chained me to a chair because they were afraid. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I used to hear it from Vuk and him all the time. You know, I laugh at some of the stuff about my life, but I don't really laugh on the inside. It was pretty, you know, because I deal with people like that. So,
but that changed your life, right?
Saved my life in many ways. And Dallas was there, and I'll never forget it, because Dallas turned around and said, you're going to a rehab. I've had it with this. And I said, no, I'm not. He goes, oh, yeah, you are. So the next day, you know, when I got out of jail, they put me in jail, so I got out on an appeal. They hired me a lawyer. So I got on, because I tore my knee up. I tore my ACL, my MCL, my knee. So I was going to be out a while. And So anyway, I know how that damage happened, but I'll keep that private. But I deserved it. So anyway, on my way back to Chicago, I went in to see we had this doctor who was an EAP, Dr. Sidney Scholl, and he had a big beard. You know, he's a psychiatrist. And I walked into his office, and I'm walking up the step with my soon-to-be wife, and she was my girlfriend at the time. She goes, "You need to go in here." I go, "Really? So you're turning on me now, you know, because you get that denial and stuff." And so I went in and I sat down. He's going to interview me. He says, "Tell me about your mother." And I was still pretty hungover. I said, because my mother was my hero in life. I said, "If you say anything about my mother, I'm going to break your freaking jaw." And I couldn't believe that came out. Mm. And I knew I was still a little bit under the weather. And so he says, "Well, tell me about your dad." So I said, "You know what? Say a word about my dad." He goes, "Okay, we're done with the interview." And he says, "Look, you're going in rehab."
Yeah.
And I go, "Really?" I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Well, Dallas said if you walk out that door." I said, "I'm walking out that door." He said, "Dallas said if you walk out that door, you're not going to play for the Cubs or anyone." And I went, "Whoa," because at that time, baseball was probably my God. I went, "Whoa, I mean, okay, I'll go." And I made up my mind that I'm going to go in there and put my dip in and ice my knee and sit in the back of the room and basically watch people tell their stories and say, "I'd never do that." And so I went into the rehab, and about the third or fourth day, another life-changing event happened in my life. There was a counselor there, and they were doing some psychodrama stuff, so I had to stand up, bad knee and all. We're on a bus, and I should have been smart enough to figure this out because we're going on a bus by Wrigley Field. And he says, "Dickie, you're on a bus, and it's crowded, and somebody steps on your toe." I said, "I wouldn't be on a bus going by Wrigley Field on a crowded bus, you know, trying to be." He said, "What would you be doing, driving your Mercedes?" I said, "I don't own a Mercedes." And he said, "Okay, well, you're on a bus, and that's where you're going to be at the rate you're going in your life. And you're going by Wrigley Field, and somebody steps on your toe." And he had cowboy boots, and I don't think he meant to do it. Later on, I found out he didn't. But he nailed my toe with those cowboy boots, and I drew back to hit him. And I don't think he was smart enough or brave enough or stupid enough to do that on purpose, but it sure did work because I did draw back to hit him. And he looked at me, and he says, "Hit me." And I said, "I can't hit you." He goes, "Why not?" I said, "Because, you know, I'm in here because I'm in trouble. I can't hit you." He goes, "No, you're not hitting me because you're sober." And for some reason, that hit me right between the eyes and in the heart. And so I kind of liked the guy, and I listened to him more and more. And then someone got up and shared their story the next day, and it made a difference to me. And the next person shared their story. And all these people had so many traumatic things going on in their life. A wife whose husband just kicked her out because she couldn't control her drinking and lost her kids. I'm going, how did you let that happen? You know, it didn't. I couldn't believe it. And I'm looking. Then I started hearing other stories. And then the counselor got me one-on-one and said, "Let me tell you about your story, since you don't want to tell nobody." And he laid it out. And when he laid it out, and he said, "I'm going to be you. I'm going to lay it out for you." And he said, "I'm Dickie Knowles. This is what I've done in my life." And I listened to him, and he says, "What would you say to someone that if I was not you and I had done those things?" I'd say, "You're probably pretty stupid, or you need treatment." And he says, "Exactly." And that day was the April 9th of 1983 date that I use. And that day I said, "I'm not drinking no more." Now, the counselor and everybody else, and I know people in AA get offended sometimes when I say I knew I wasn't going to drink no more. I was determined on that date to try to follow the program and not drink one day at a time. That's what I was trying to say. And I said, if I can go sober one day, that's what they're saying is at work. I think I want to do this. And I also was at a disadvantage if I wanted to drink because all eyes were on me. Mm. I had been sentenced to 180 days in a jail. Major League Baseball came down on me. I'd lost lots of money. I was going to have to play for another year and a half to cover those debts. So I was playing for nothing. But the most important thing was my mother. My mother, 60 Minutes aired it and put it on television. So I had to watch myself go into jail. And the thing that hit me the most was my mother and grandmother had to watch me walk into jail and say, "How did he end up like that?" Mm. And a lot of people don't understand addictions, and I'm sure they didn't. And so that was a thing that really bothered me the most of the whole thing was, not only what I'd done to my life, what I'd done to my family.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Well, next year it'll be 40 years if you think of that, Dickie. And that's quite an accomplishment. you guys talked about it, change your life. Let's take a little break, and then when we come back, we really would like to talk to you how now, you know, you get to tell your story and help you know, some of our minor leaguers and other people in the organization. So let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Dickie Knowles.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
And we're back. And Dickie, as John mentioned and you mentioned, it changed your life. And I guess it was 1996 you became part of the with the employee assistance program here at the Phillies, right?
Yeah, I got a job with the Phillies April 1st of 1992, though I was doing some stuff with a program I called SAVE, Students, Attitudes, Values, Education, Substance Abuse. It was a prevention program. And I loved doing that. At that point in my career, I didn't know where I was going. I wanted to play baseball, and David had kind of took me in.
David Montgomery.
I had asked Bill Giles, love you, Bill, this is no offense. I asked Bill Giles because in the offseason I was doing that program for the Phillies because at that time a lot of drug and alcohol programs, especially in the state of New Jersey, you had the governor's council over there, you had people speaking in schools, you had drug and alcohol in schools, you had DARE. Right. So I started doing that down in Texas before I got traded here. And so not to get traded here before I signed here. So when I left Texas to sign here, I'd already done that in Texas for a couple of years. So when I got here, I continued to do it. And Karen Howard and Vince Noss and Karen Howard, Regina Castellani, and Kelly. Kelly was down
Kelly,
there.
Sure.
They were all the community relations people down there, and they were getting those requests. And Vince had told them because first thing I did when I got here, I did two things. I found a sponsor. And I found a Bible study group, and Vince Noss was doing the Bible study. And so I went over to his house, and he says, you know what? What are you doing? I said, well, I'm doing nothing. I'm looking for a job. He says, well, I can get you an off-season job. We're getting this, and I heard about your program. We're getting this request. Saves was invented by Karen Howard, though, because it's a funny story, too. But she used to get on me all the time when I was speaking because I'd bring up the name of Jesus sometimes because, see, to me, when I left Texas, I left an area where you could talk about the Lord, and I got up here north, and when you'd say something about the Lord and your faith, they would look at you like, whoa, did he just say that? You know where you at? And so there was many times I went out and spoke for the Phillies, and I'd come back, and Karen go, what did you do? And she was supposed to be my assistant, but she thought she was my boss, and she'd say, what did you do today? I go, what do you mean? I went and spoke at that school. She goes, oh, my Lord. She said, do you know what you said? I go, yeah, I was the guy. I think so. I'm the guy presenting. What are you talking about? Oh, did you said, how many times did you say God? I go, I don't know. She goes, you got to be careful. Some people don't like that. I go, okay. So one day, Blue Cross Blue Shield decides to sponsor the program. And on the other side of Broad Street, on the left-hand side, there's a Jesus Save sign. And it's been there forever. So I'm sitting there, and she goes, Blue Cross Blue Shield wants to sponsor your program. What's the name of it? I said, I told you, Saves. And I'm looking at that sign. And I had the one in Texas was Operation Save. Me and Dave Stewart had named it that. So I seen that sign, and I was just kind of, you know, giving her a little shot, going, Jesus Saves. And she hung up on me. And I was like, hey. And she called me back, and she said, you know, we didn't have cell phones then. So I was trying to figure out directions. I think I was on a payphone. I can't remember where I was calling from, but I remember calling her about directions. And I said to her, I said, Saves. She goes, well, what does it stand for? I go, don't know.
And so
we sat there, and we both went back and forth, and most of it she came up with, and I've looked back over it, and I've got a lot of credit for it, but she, you know, I students, attitudes, values, education, substance abuse. I think I came up with athletes, attitudes, and addictions, which was the A. And I think she came up with values, which I never was big on that. I'm big on values, but not that title. And then education, she said, education is going to be, thing you'd like to do in schools when you go in and, like health classes and talk about the effects of alcohol and marijuana on the brain and the heart and stuff. And I said, okay, substance abuse would be my story, the thing I least like doing. And I said, what's the first S stand for? She goes, well, why don't you do making the right choices because you like to talk about that a lot, and decisions and dreams because you talk about that a lot. And so she was the she was the backbone to the program. Yeah, and she,
now,
she
had other teams got into that at that point? I mean, I know obviously most teams in most leagues right now have, you know, different programs, but did they have someone like you, other baseball teams?
I think some teams had started down that road of bringing former players in. And, you know, it always appalled me because Texas did it first. Why are you bringing somebody in that did all the bad things? To me, a better spokesperson would have been a Cal Ripken. I did an autograph show with Cal Ripken one time in Baltimore. I pitched in Baltimore. I had the worst two starts of my career, and I only had two down there. I got crushed. And the highest ERA of anybody, I'm sure. And I get called down to do an autograph thing, and I get there, and it's Cal Ripken. I go, this is going to be fun. And Cal Ripken is doing autographs, and I'm sitting on this side doing autographs, and I've done two, and he's done about 2,000. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, I'm getting paid. And finally, there's an audience afterwards. People are getting to meet us. We're sitting up there and talk to us. And I'm really sitting there thinking, how did I get down here? Who was dumb enough to get me to be a, you know, maybe they needed somebody. And it's kind of on the border of Philly and Oriole territory down in Lancaster. And so I'm sitting there, and a guy goes, he's asking all these questions. Everybody's asking Cal a question. The guy goes, hey, Cal, I want to ask a question. Would you do anything different in your career? And I hadn't really thought about any of the questions that he were asking. He, as a matter of fact, Cal's such a wonderful guy, one of my favorite people. He kept saying, you know, Dickie played for the Phillies. And, you know, and thank God he didn't say Orioles. And so the guy goes, would you do anything different in your career? He goes, nothing. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him, and he goes, and he really, he had some thought in it. He said, I wouldn't do anything different. I worked hard. I showed up every day. I played hard. I don't think I could have done anything different. And in the back of my mind, I'm going, I hope this guy don't ask me that question.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And he did.
That's a loaded question.
And he did. And I looked at him, and I said everything. Right. And he looked at me, and he says, what do you mean? You got a World Series ring? You played with the Phil? I said, I would have done everything different. Mm. He goes, well, define that. I said, well, it starts with life. I would have not drank. I would have, many people have asked me, they said, would you have been a more of a social drinker? I said, to me, it would have been too big of a risk because I became an alcoholic. And I said, I wouldn't have done many things that I did. I've taken better care of myself. And I said, it would have helped in my career. I would have enjoyed my career because when you look at my career, when I was drinking, I was known as a headhunter too, a title I really hated. And you can't just, you know, you can't say a guy has a temper, settle your temper down. I think anger has a way of manifesting itself in a bad temper sometimes. And I think many of us in this game, we don't want to admit it, but we like the macho stuff, you know, especially being a relief pitcher. You like it thrown at you. This guy's tough. But after a while, when you become the guy who's got to hit everybody, when somebody gets hit, you become the guy who's got to take care of all the fights. It gets a little to where you're like, I want to pitch. I don't want to have to. I started the first fight in Scranton Wilkes-Barre history after doing Bible study. Now, how about that? Because of my old reputation.
Well, let's talk about, you mentioned card shows, but you also mentioned about hitting, or maybe in this case you didn't hit somebody, but you came close. Talk about, I love the fact, you know, 1980, a lot of people say, and I know you've heard this, you've been asked this story many times, a lot of people say the pitch to George Brett that knocked him on his duff basically changed the course of the World Series, right? He was on a tear. You knock him down. Then he didn't do anything. We win the World Series. And then afterwards, you do a lot of card shows with George Brett. So talk about that moment in the World Series and kind of lead the listeners into that, what happened.
Well, you know, I'm honored by the fact that people think it changed the World Series. Let me say at first, I don't really believe it had any effect on the World Series. But I will say this, it had some effect on them during that game. I know that because I could see that because they all wanted to kill me. But, you know, coming up to that pitch, what had happened was we won the first two games, and then they won one in extra innings. And then the next day, that Larry Christensen, and a lot of people don't remember this, but LC was a good pitcher, and his dad was very ill and later passed. I can't remember when he passed. I don't think he passed at that time. My memory is not great on that subject, but LC was really pitching with a, you know, you in baseball, sometimes you got to really go out and block everything out. And a little thing in a World Series, as well as they were swinging, could throw you off. And so I believe Willie Wilson led off the game with maybe a walk or something. And LC, I don't know, he was on first base. LC threw the ball away. I was telling the story, Tom, for many years. I was telling it wrong, but I know the story now because I thought I came in with the bases loaded. I never went back and look at that. And that was a negative on my part. A lot of people ask me about the pitch. I refuse to go back and look at it because I'll tell you my philosophy when I'm done telling you the story of why I didn't. So finally, LC throws the ball away. Willie went to third. He got Frank White out. Brett hits a triple. He's coming off his hemorrhoids. And Willie Mays Akins hit a bomb and never left home plate. Hal McCray hits a single to right center, maybe to right field. He hit one to center and stretched it to a double, one to right.
Yeah, this was all in the first inning, Dickie.
First inning. Yeah. He stretched a single to a double and slid in very hard to second. Pop-up slide. Fans, people do not realize this, but Kansas City fans got loud, and a lot of people remembered that. They were very loud. I think they were trying to show Philadelphia fans that we can get loud too. And then Amos Otis, great ball player, came up and hit one off the right center field wall, inches from maybe a foot from going out of the ballpark. Big ballpark then at that time. So they were hitting balls all over the ballpark. So I come into the game. First guy I face, I strike out, I think on three pitches, Daryl Porter. Next guy was Clint Hurdle. I walked him on four pitches. That's the kind of pitcher I was, you know. And so then I infield hit by UL Washington, and the bases were loaded. For many years, I thought I came in with the bases loaded. I would have swore by that. But when I finally looked at myself pitch for the first time, I think like 2 or 3 years ago, I finally looked at my performance. I would never look at it. And when I looked at it, I said, "Hot dang, I was throwing good. I was throwing fastballs right by people, and I had control that game and a very good slider." And so I get out of first inning on a ground ball by William Wilson again, and I spiked the ball like Rose did, which I didn't know I did that until I looked at it again. And I slammed the ball down like Rose and walked off the field. And so the second inning, I pitched well. Third inning, I pitched well. The fourth inning, Brett's going to be up. Now, there's a lot of chatter in our dugout, and there was a lot of chatter in the bullpen, you know, about we need to do something to let them know, you know, these guys are getting too comfortable at home plate. We have a way as teammates to let you know. Tug was the greatest. I mean, he's sitting on the bench, and I'm sitting there. And Marty Bystrom, I call him Hard Marty for nothing. He's one of my dearest friends. I love the guy. He's like a brother. He walked by me, and he says, "Yeah, they're getting pretty comfortable up there. You know, don't be afraid to knock somebody down." And I looked at him. I said, "I'm going to." And I think it was Bobby Walk may have said something, and then Tug said something. And you know, they're all encouraging you, kind of like, "Hey, go out there and knock somebody down."
Nudge, wink, wink.
And then Tug got up and stretched and says, "Yeah, you got to show me. I'm from Missouri." And I go, "Cute," you know, because we're playing in Kansas City and all that. And I said, "That's Tugger." And Tug kind of had a way of saying, "Hey, Pi, you need to." And that and being a veteran, him and Ron Reed were, they always took care of a bullpen as good as anybody ever. Tug and Ron Reed really controlled us in the bullpen. And Mike Ryan was our coach, so that says enough right there. But these guys were the best teachers I ever played with anywhere, you know, other than Ferguson Jenkins. Just fantastic teachers while they were playing. So I knew I got to do it. So I run out to the mound. I said, "It's going to be easy. I'm going to drill Willie Mays Akins." And I'm going to ask him, I'm going to say, "Hey, you can't run now, can you?" Because he watched in the second inning, he hit one off of me. First homer in the second, which was his fourth. And when he hit it so far, I like to watch him. I'm a different pitcher. When I threw it and some guy really hit one, I wanted to watch it. So I turned around to watch it, and I heard Pete. "Hey, Willie, you better run." I heard Pete say that. I turned around, and I looked, and he hasn't moved.
Still in the box.
So I'm hollering at him with all that loud noise. "Hey, you better run." And he just looked at me like he couldn't hear what I was saying. So I as he's running, I said, "Yeah, you keep walking. You better run." And he got – pretty close to first base, I said, "I'm going to drill you." I wanted him to read my lips. And so I'm waiting on that. So the fourth inning, he's going to be the second hitter. And I'd already got Brett out, and I'm waiting. You know, Brett gets up there. Now, I was a big George Brett fan. Who wouldn't be? Just a fantastic hitter, hit 390. So the first pitch I throw, and I throw it by him, and the second pitch I throw it by him. And it's a guy that could turn on anybody's fastball. He just did Goose Gossage to beat the Yankees in the upper deck, 99. And I'm feeling pretty good about my heater as I'm watching this over. I'm going, "I just threw two fastballs by that guy. He had no chance." And so the next pitch, people don't understand this. And this is what I told George at dinner when he was at dinner. People don't understand this. We went to dinner when Kansas City played here, and he came by and he said, "Did you really throw at me?" I got to be honest. Yes and no. But let me tell you what. Yes, I was throwing it where it went. Bob Boone says I lost it. I had to lose it. I'd thrown a lot of pitches up there. Following year, I hit somebody in the head, and the next year, I hit somebody in the head. It changed me forever. I would never throw up there again. When we were young, we were taught to come in. If you come in and you hit them, you got him 0-2, you wasted that whole, you know, you got him 0-2, worked hard to get him 0-2, you hit him. So we would throw up here. And I was thrown at my face. That's probably why I never got hit a lot. And so I figured I was going to throw it up there, not with the intent of really hitting him.
Right.
This is where it gets confusing. With the intent, well, you better get out of the way. I'm sending you a message because that next sucker, I'm going to hit him, but I was going to hit him right in the rear end. That's where you throw it in the rear end, they can't get out of the way. So I threw
especially with the problems that he had before.
Yeah, he had hemorrhoids that game, that series.
But Brett did the most athletic flip, and the ball, when you slow it down.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Now, you can look at this two ways. Number one, and let me finish it, and then I'll tell you why I didn't like talking about it. And so when I flipped him, he hit the ground. He kind of spun around, and the whole stadium went silent. And I kind of caught how he flipped. I went, man, that was pretty good. I mean, and I knew that everybody on that dugout was upset. But Rose is the one. If there's anything that pitch did, it gave Pete Rose, the ultimate competitor, the opportunity to turn that on our side. Because if Pete doesn't get involved, I don't think the pitch is anything other than inciting them to probably.
Well, Fry comes out of the dugout.
Fry comes out. He's screaming at me. Yep. And he's going, stop it right now. Stop it right now. And he's hollering, stop it right now. And I'm looking at him like, I hope this old man don't come out here because that's going to be embarrassing because I'm going to have to run from an old man. I ain't going to hit an old man. You know, I'm thinking that. That's what I'm thinking as a 23-year-old. Like, I don't want no old man to come out here.
It's like Don Zimmer and right, Pedro.
Yeah. And I would have not – if he would have came after me, I would have not went anywhere near him. But if Brett would have came at me, that would have been a little bit different. But Brett was too smart to do that. So Brett's laying there and Fry, stop it right now. Stop it right now. What people don't understand and about this, and I didn't know until many years later, is Billy Connors looked at Jim Fry and said, hey, this guy pitching out there, and I got a left-hander in the bullpen, Kevin Sauché, said, the way we're playing, we need to be a little careful. They'll flip you. And he said, they'll flip you more than once. He just told him that, and I flipped Brett.
Yeah.
And I was unaware of that for many years. But Billy said, I just told him, and you flipped Brett right after the next pitch.
There it is.
And Brett went down, hit the dirt, spun around, and was just staring at me like, you threw at my head. And I said, yeah, I did. That's why I was staring back at him. And then Pete goes, he wasn't throwing at him. He says, stop it right now. And he's throwing at him. And Pete goes, he wasn't throwing at him. And Frank's trying to get it. Pete's trying to get it. Fry and Gordy McKenzie's grabbing Pete. Pete goes, if he was throwing at him, it'd hit him. I don't think Fry knew how to handle
that's
that.
A good
nobody,
line, right?
Nobody that's a good could out talk Pete. And Pete right. was sitting there and Fry was like, you know, I seen that. And then Pete turned around and looked at their dugout, and he said, if you want to throw at any of those guys, you go right ahead. Pitch your own blanking ball game.
Nice.
And their whole bench sat down.
Yeah.
Because Pete Rose,
right,
endorsed the pitch.
Yeah. And then it turned the series, John. That's history right there.
That's history right there.
All right, listen, we got to let's take a quick break, and we got the quiz for Dickie. Dickie, you're going to get a quiz in a minute here.
And so, a song to introduce the quiz.
Oh, yeah, we got a new theme song, all this and more when we come back right after this.
Thanks for the visit. Let's get down to business. Now here's your chance to show how much you really know. He might get grumpy if he can't stump you with Brazier's Quiz.
And we're back. And, John, you got your quiz papers out. And I know you worked hard on this one because it's Dickie Ray.
Exactly right. Well, Dickie, I asked you a couple questions on the golf course, and you probably were thinking it's was something, you know,
you were doing research
I'm
yesterday?
Just casually asking you questions, but I got a little answers
research.
Out of them.
Okay, all right.
Because I found out yesterday that you went to Harding University High School.
North Carolina.
Right? Yep, in Charlotte, North Carolina.
It was called Harding High then.
Harding High, now it's called Harding University High School. All right, first of all, there's eight questions. And we usually set the bar, you have to get 6 out of 8, all right? Okay. So, but it's all about your life, so you should have an inside track.
And right? A little bit of calculus thrown in.
Yes, throwing a little algebra and calculus in there, too. All right, so you went to Harding University. Which, first of all, what does he win, Tom? We could give him the Hers Ladies Clutch that we're giving away to all women 15 and over next Sunday when we play the Mets for
there
Mother's
it is.
Day. Do you have
nice plug, John?
I'm sure you could give that to somebody.
He's a real professional. He
my
that
daughter.
Right in there.
My
all right,
daughter.
For your daughter's going to get this. So do this for your daughter. All right, so you went to Harding University High School. Which of these celebrities did not go to that high school? Okay, so I'm going to mention 4 people, celebrities.
Okay.
3 of them went to that high school. 1 did not. You got to tell me which one did not. All right. A, Ray Durham, former Major League Baseball second baseman, right? Two-time All-Star, former Cub. Ron Killings, professional wrestler in WWE. Jim Nabors, who played Gomer Pyle. And Anthony Hamilton, who's a singer, songwriter, and record producer. So was it Ray Durham, Ron Killings, the wrestler, Jim Nabors, or Anthony Hamilton?
Jim Nabors.
Jim Nabors is correct. You're one for one. How did you know Jim Nabors didn't go to your high school?
That was a pretty good chance that was going to be the answer. I didn't know two of the other guys, but I know Ray Durham pretty good.
All right. Your first minor league team, I found out yesterday, was the Auburn Phillies.
Yeah.
Right in 1975. I was doing a little sneaky research on you, Dickie. In the New York Penn League, again, 1975. Which one of these was not one of your teammates? Okay. Three teammates from that Auburn team in 1975. One was not. A, Steve Kruselak, if I said that correctly.
Kruselak.
B, Blake Summerfield. C, Orlando Isalis. And D, Neil Cooper.
Who was the second
Blake
one?
Blake Summerfield. Yeah, Blake is our...
I think he probably knows Blake.
Well, Blake's head of our business analytics here at the Phillies. So, yes, you probably know Blake. He's got a good baseball name, though, right? Blake Summerfield.
Orlando Isalis was on the 80 team.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Do you remember him, Tom?
He had 600 or what, four? I think he was 3 for 4.
Huh. All right. So you are 2 for 2. You're on
two
a roll, right? All right. Your nemesis, George Brett. We talked about George Brett earlier. He is one of 5 players to have 3,000 hits, 300 home runs, and a career 300 batting average. How about that?
Ooh.
Right?
Awesome.
Which one of these is not one of the other players? So three of the players I'm going to mention had 3,000 hits at least, 300 home runs, and a career 300. One did not. Which one did not? A, Barry Bonds. B, Hank Aaron. C, Willie Mays. D, Stan Musial.
Barry Bonds.
Barry Bonds is correct. He was at 2,935 hits, and he was at a 298 batting average.
I was going to say, maybe he
wasn't. Obviously, he did it on the home runs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was close, 298.
Yeah.
The other one was Miguel Cabrera, if you're playing at home. So just to let you know. So you are 3 for 3, Dickie. Very good.
On fire.
All right. You were drafted in the 4th round. We talked about this yesterday, too. You were drafted in the 4th round of the 1975 draft. Who was not drafted after you? So 3 of these players were drafted after you. One was drafted before you.
Okay.
So which one was – so in other words, who was drafted before you? You have A, Lou Whitaker, B, Andre Dawson, C, Bob Horner, D, Lee Smith.
These players were in the draft?
Yes, 1975.
Okay. 1975.
And 3 of them were picked after you. One was picked before you. So it was a Lou Whitaker, Andre Dawson, Bob Horner, Lee Smith. If you look at this class,
you're asking who was picked before me?
Yes.
Bob Horner.
No, Bob Horner was picked in the 15th round. Lee Smith was drafted in the 2nd round.
Wow.
Yeah, how about that?
I was getting ready to think. I thought Lee Smith was the 2nd or 3rd round, but I thought Bob Horner was the number one.
No, 15th round. Andre Dawson was 11th round. Yeah. Lou Whitaker was 5th round. How about that? But if you go back to that draft, look at those players in the 1975 draft.
Oof.
One of the best drafts ever. So, all right.
You're
on a good roll. You're batting 750, all right? So here you go. Number 5, you were traded for yourself in 1987. We didn't even get into that.
That's so cool.
Right? It's happened only 3 other times. Did you know that? Which player was not traded for himself? Okay, I'm going to mention 4 people. One was not traded for himself. A is Brad Golden. B is Eric Pesch. C is Harry Chitty. And D is John McDonald.
McDonald.
No, it's Eric Pesch, who's our merch guy.
I wish I would have known Eric.
You know Eric. You see
I know
him.
Eric.
Bald, works with Scott Brandreth.
I had no idea of any of those. I just took a guess.
Have room. You just got to go 3 for 3, and I think you're going to do this.
Yeah, you got this.
All right, in 1980, this is more baseball related, so you're going to be good. In 1980, who was second to Mike Schmidt with 87 RBI? Second to Mike Schmidt with 87 RBI. Schmidt, he had 121. Was it Bull, Gary Maddox, Bake McBride, or Pete Rose?
You mean on our club?
On your club in 1980. Who was second?
Shake and Bake.
Shake and Bake is correct.
It's going to be my
guess. You are correct.
Too.
All right, here we go. You need just 2 more. In 1980, who was second to Steve Carlton in strikeouts with 94? Steve Carlton, who was second to Steve Carlton in strikeouts? He had 94. Okay.
That's it?
Yeah. Was it Bob Walk, Dick Ruthven, Randy Lurch or Larry Christensen?
It was Dick Ruthven, but I challenged that 94.
Bob Walk had 94.
Bobby Walk.
Bob Walk had 94. Dick Ruthven had 86.
In the whole season?
Yeah. Unless I look, I always
Bob Walk came up.
You know
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
Bob Walk you know came what? Up late. You know what, Dickie? I always screw up one question. That
I
might
think
be
that's
a
the
screw
one
up.
You screwed up.
All right. Well, Scott Brandeth is our resident historian. He will be the first
you
one to tell me
right,
if I screwed up.
But you may be right.
All right. Ready? Last question. You ready for this one?
Yep.
I figured I'd end on an easy one. You were born in Charlotte, North Carolina. We talked about that. Which of these celebs was not born in Charlotte, North Carolina? Okay. Which of these celebs was not born in Charlotte, North Carolina? Okay, here we have A, Seth Curry, B, Luke Combs, country singer, C, Jim Nance, sportscaster, the Masters, right? D, Gene Rayburn, host of Match Game 76. So was it Seth Curry, Luke Combs, Jim Nance, or Gene Rayburn?
I'm going to say Gene Rayburn.
Gene Rayburn is correct. And Tom will tell you that I always, most podcasts, I mention somebody from Match Game 76. Whether it's Fannie Flagg, Nipsey Russell, Bill Cullen, Charles Nelson Reilly, anybody else.
Everybody's favorite.
All right, you did a good job. And
you got me looking up Ruthven. I can't believe he wouldn't have more strikeouts.
Man, Bob Walk was such a late call-up that year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he came.
Bob
September.
Walk was a power pitcher then. Bob Walk yep. threw really
yeah, maybe
hard.
Maybe he had 94 strikeouts in the month of
well,
September.
We're not going to spend this whole podcast looking through the stats here.
We'll
so
make Brandert
we'll
do
look
it.
We'll have Scott Brandert look at it. And, Dickie, you know what? I think because of the confusion, you win a HERS ladies clutch
You're
crossbody.
You're exactly right. He only had 86 strikeouts.
Yeah, see, I was right.
How about that?
Yeah. He wins a HERS ladies crossbody clutch.
Absolutely.
That we're giving away to all fans.
You got
to
give
all
everybody
women,
a trophy even though they don't win.
There you go. All right.
Can I make one last comment?
Sure.
I mean, I love both of you guys, but I want to make this comment because I want you to understand this. You know, when you look at what we're doing now and you know, how you make people feel, you know, I want his title. I really want his title. That's what my next. I've told you that before.
You already got it, Dickie.
Let's switch
yeah,
jobs.
You are the director of
but
funny games.
I want to say one thing about both of you guys. You guys mean a lot to the Phillies. You know, you do a great job in the community. What you do is phenomenal. I mean, you can't even go there, you know. And, I mean, when you think about it, I was just thinking about someone that just that I just talked to that you made a big impact in their life. And I can't even remember who it is right now. But, I'm trying to think of an event. I've seen the pictures and everything else. Oh, last night we were at the awards ceremony.
Sports Writers Banquet. Okay.
And a doctor was a doctor. I wish I could remember her name. I've had a lot to happen today. I've been dealing with a whole lot of things today on the EP field. But the doctor sat beside me and Bois. She was honored for her work in the COVID. She came to the ballpark here to give the shots out. And she told Larry and she told the whole audience. And there was a young lady up there from soccer that won an award. She didn't know the 1980 Flyers or the 1980 Phillies or the 1980, you know, because we all won that year, the Eagles. So she's sitting there and she goes up to get her award and she goes, this is a great award. She goes, Larry, I watched you in eighth grade, you and Dickie, and I watched, you know, she turned around. I was a big fan, but she showed me pictures on her phone. And what you did and the impact you two make. So I appreciate both
awesome.
Of you guys.
Well, Dickie,
you guys
we appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks, Dickie.
One of our all-time favorites, and we are proud to call you a coworker since 1996.
Amen. I think I need to introduce myself to a few other coworkers there. You got some questions.
Blake Summerfield and Eric Pesch, to name a couple.
Yeah.
Dickie, we really appreciate you coming on. And that was great, John. I guess we're wrapping it up.
We're wrapping it up.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you next time on Phillies Backstage.